Earth to humans.
Hi, I'm Hannah Mulvaney, a nomadic wildlife biologist from the UK. I'm going to start this episode kind of differently today because I want to talk a little about my relationship to the place that will be discussed. This is a place that has become almost a symbol of the demise of forests, with many a deforestation campaign using it within their imagery, and it's regularly used as an example of a place where things are going very wrong. When I was 18, my parents bought me what would turn out to be the most life-altering present I've ever received, a holiday to Borneo. This would be the second time I'd ever left Europe. At this point, I knew two things about Borneo, that there were orangutans and loads of rainforests. I remember the feeling stepping off the plane. It was the very first time I'd felt proper humidity. After all, my birthday's in December and we were visiting over Christmas, right in the middle of the monsoon season. We began our travels in earnest, with just 2.5 weeks to see as much of the place as we could. The main attraction for us being the Sepalok Orangutan Rehabilitation Centre. We'd met a local guide, Ben, who would provide us with his incredible knowledge to ensure that we went to all of the best places and had the absolute best time possible. We set off for the rehabilitation centre, and on our 3+ hour drive, I didn't see one patch of forest, just palm oil plantations. Despite being crazy about nature since I can remember, this was an issue I hadn't really heard much about, and neither had anyone else really at that point. This is now going back 13 years ago. This is also pre-food producers having to write palm oil on their ingredient lists, and way before the establishment of the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil. On asking our guide about where the forest was, he replied that we'd get to it in a few hours. My vision of Borneo was turning out to be totally wrong. We arrived at the rehabilitation centre, a small patch of jungle bordered by more palm oil plantations, to see orangutans who'd been rescued and re-released. As one of my ultimate favourite animals, I was in awe to see these incredible creatures close up and watch their agility as they manoeuvred through the trees with complete ease. Then, a moment of drama. A male orangutan took a bit of a fancy to me, and following me along the boardwalk, then grabbing my bag, pulling my purse out and biting it, resulting in all of my bank cards being snapped in half, and Ben having to scare him off by whipping his belt on the ground next to him. This is something I believe my auntie may have actually caught on camera, and unfortunately never sent it into one of those home video shows where you win money if you've been featured. Although I'm not actually sure my embarrassment would have been worth the prize money at that point. After I'd recovered, we began to walk around the forest close by to the centre and spotted a mother orangutan with her baby high up in the trees. This moment changed me forever. I knew from that moment onwards I wanted to help them, and not just them, as many animals as I could. We continued our holiday, travelling miles past palm oil plantations to get to the places we were visiting, where we saw pygmy elephants crossing a river, birds and fish of every colour you can imagine, hairy-nosed otters, and the extremely weird yet charismatic proboscis monkey. And also, so much rainforest. However, I left Borneo with a heavy heart. All of these amazing, unique, bizarre, beautiful animals restricted to ever-declining pockets of forest. I did more research, discovering that there were so many more factors causing the decline of their ecosystems, and knew that I wanted to dedicate the rest of my life to doing whatever I could do to help these animals and any other animal that I could. Since then, I've always followed and supported conservation organisations in Borneo. I was in London to attend the Whitley Awards, a nature conservation charity who offer funding, profile and training to grassroots conservation leaders in the Global South. I listened to the bio of one of the award winners, who had founded a charity in Borneo, Yayasan Asri. This was an organisation like I'd never heard of before, whose work was both humanitarian and environmental, and whose impact was huge. and was so unique that I, having already worked with 350 conservation charities around the world in my short career, had never heard of anything similar. I'm absolutely not one for doom and gloom, so I consistently seek out and dissipate good news stories and prove that conservation does work. It just needs everyone's belief and support. My interview today does just that. And now that I've set the scene, I'm going to welcome Mahardika Putraprabha to the Earth to Humans podcast, the research and program consultant at ASRI. Today on the Earth to Humans podcast, we have Deeka from ASRI, which is an amazing organization that is based in Indonesia. I came across the organization in 2016 when I was attending the Whitley Awards, which is a grant-giving award ceremony based in the UK, and it focuses solely on community conservation projects. So these are conservation projects that really, really bring in people. People are the main focus of these projects, and wildlife and the environment always benefit from them. So I'm really, really excited to talk to Deeka today, who is going to give us a little bit more information. So Deeka, do you want to start by introducing yourself?
Yes. So hello, I'm Deeka. I'm actually the former program director at ASRI, but I just currently resigning from my positions. But because the fund that I have with the organizations, I'm continuing supporting the organizations even upon my departure. So I'm now actually working as their program and research consultant.
That's wonderful that even though you're leaving, you want to stay.
Yeah.
So the organization must be pretty great then.
Yeah, because of the value of the organizations, and I see how the organizations have been very, you know, very impactful to the community surrounds them. So I decided to continue supporting the organizations.
Fantastic. So ASRI is actually a shortened version of the full name of the organization. So can you tell us the full name and what that means?
So the full name of the organization is actually Alam Sehat Lestari. It means that nature, healthy, sustainability. So we believe that human health and the health of the environment are interconnected. And if one is not healthy, so neither can be. So we believe the interconnectedness.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you. So with the project, when I was listening to it, so for listeners, the video that was produced for the Whitley Awards, which was actually narrated by Sir David Attenborough, will be shared on the show note of the podcast. It gives you some insight into what the organization is and the area where it works. But the organization itself, it is so unique and so innovative, and I've never ever come across another organization that's doing anything similar. Even in the past 5 years since I've been aware of ASRI and the work that it does. So could you just go back to, I think the organization was started in 2007, if I'm not mistaken. So can we go back to 2007 prior to that and actually discuss what the need was and why the organization was started in the first place?
I think before go to 2007, so before that, for many years, our founder, you know, our organizations, we've been trying to telling people that their health and well-being are affected by the health and well-being of people that living in rainforests, the communities that half a world away. But it has only been with the pandemic that we recently experienced that most people are finally getting it. They say, yes, now I see what you mean. We really are all interconnected, right? So we believe that it isn't just local human health and local rainforest health that are connected. Climate change, pandemic, biodiversity loss are all interconnected with our well-being. And one of the connections that our founder saw was that the rainforest, she was living in a rainforest at the time, it was disappearing around her. So she can hear chainsaw all day, you know, the sound of the tree falling down all day. And she wanted to understand why these people were logging on the rainforest. And she found out that many people log because they needed to pay for healthcare. So for example, he met a man that need to cut 60 giant trees to pay for a family member healthcare. It's actually to pay for his wife's C-sections for labor. At the time she was like, it's very in a desperate situation. And then when she go back to the United States, she start studying medical and being a medical student. And then after she graduate from medical degree, she got a medical degree, she came back to Indonesia and then start going around the village and then talking with the community and then gain more insights about the root cause of the problem. She believes, and we believe, that the rainforest communities are the experts and know the solution. So before we begin our program in Gunung Palung National Park in West Kalimantan, Indonesia, so we did many hours of what we call radical listening. So we listened to community. We asked them one question, actually. At the time, we asked them, what do you need in order to stop logging and live in harmony with the rainforest? So we asked them as an expert, and we also encouraged them, you are all guardians of this precious rainforest. What would you all need as a thank you from the world community so that you could protect it? And at the time, they asking for two main things. The first one, they responded that they needed high quality, affordable healthcare. And then second, they asked for training in organic farming. What's very interesting was that their solution addressed the complex interconnectedness of the root cause of logging. So their solutions were in silos. They didn't see this as a medical issue, or this is as an economic issue, or this is a conservation problem. They saw all the issues as interconnected, human well-being dependent on ecosystem integrity and health, and vice versa. So that's the initial work that we did. And then with the solutions that come from community, we implemented those solutions, but we also tied them with an agreement. So if we help you, the solution that you just mentioned, then you have to agree that you will protect the rainforest. So that's how our program come into places. So we built a clinic in 2007. We gave medical healthcare to the communities nearby. And then we also provide an incentive systems where they can pay with non-cash, they can pay with non-cash payment. And then, but we also monitor their village, whether they did what they said that they will protecting rainforest. So that's what we did. And then since 2007, it's been working quite up and down with community because it's not easy working with community, especially we have to build trust with them. But yeah, it's been working well up till now.
I really enjoy the expression radical listening.
It's something that when you look back historically on a lot of conservation programs, it's actually something that's completely missed out, is listening at all. And for a conservation program to be sustainable, you need buy-in from local people. They have to support the program, because otherwise the second everyone kind of leaves the project site, then everything's going to fall apart. So that radical listening is something that needs to be done in every single conservation project and an environmental program. And I think conservation is catching up with that, which is really encouraging. But the fact that you guys in 2007 really started with that, it just goes to actually show how it's sustainable and how much support the project has got within your community.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I mean, our founder always saying that it needs an open heart, a really big heart to listen to people. And it needs respect, humility, truthful, you know, you have to admit what you don't know, what you can't do, you know, but at the same time, you don't judge the community. And it's showing the respect to the community, because we understanding that the communities are the experts. You know, we studied about rainforest in school, but actually when we talk about rainforest, they're living in a rainforest, you know, their whole life. So if we want to know more about rainforest, we should ask this community about it, you know, but they oftenly neglected by either by the policy, we're not going into that, but you know, either by the policy or a lot of things. So that's what we did. We listened to people, and Yeah, it's difficult in the beginning because, you know, you ask them one question and a lot of people were talking. Sometimes it can be tense and then there's a lot of conflict in the discussions as well. But at the end of the day, they can come into one voices. It's collective decisions. And then they say that they need, at the time they said they need high quality, affordable healthcare, and we need also training in organic farming. And then collectively around communities surrounded by the rainforest, they have the same idea. And that's why we developed that program.
So something else that you've said about the organization that I just think is wonderful is that you asked, rather than going in and just telling people what to do, you've asked and you've gone in with a really, really open mind, open heart, and just completely listened to what they've said, which I just think is fantastic. What I was kind of surprised by, so obviously when you think about the local people doing getting involved in deforestation and things like that, it's actually really, it's quite easy for somebody far away to almost demonize those people for doing something that is technically bad for the environment. And it fits in the same criteria for me as people who kind of poach and things like that. When you have a family member who's suffering or who is potentially not going to be educated or is in a bad situation with certain people, there's all these stories that you hear from poachers and from loggers and things like that about the situation that they're in. And if you look at the human element of that, they're not doing it because they want to destroy the rainforest. They're not doing it because they want to kill an elephant. They're not doing it because they want to do those things. It's often the only option that they have. And actually, in this situation, you've got people who live in the rainforest their entire lives exist because of the rainforest, and without that rainforest health they couldn't live there. So they're suffering at the hands of the thing that they're doing. It's not because they want to do it. That's not in any way part of their motivation to go and cut down a tree. So that must have been something that you heard from people, is that that's not why they're doing it.
Yeah. They need to choose between short-term well-being and long-term well-being. They know that if the rainforest does not exist, then there will be no water. Temperature will keep rising. You know, there will be no food at all. They understand the existence of the rainforest. But sometimes it's a dilemma for them. Oh, food on the table, the health of my family, or the forest there. It's a very dilemmatic situations and very complicated situations sometimes. Oh, I saw there's a lot of timber right there. There's a lot of trees that I can chop down to feed my family, to pay for healthcare for my family. But then I also understand if I cut down that forest, there will be no water, because they understand this at the moment. You know, right now, when I talk to one community, what is the difference between 10 years ago and right now? And they talked to me and they said, oh, like 10 years ago, if the dry season approached, we still have a water because there's still rainforest exists there. But right now, even before the dry seasons approach, towards the end of the rainy season, there will be no water for us to enjoy. There will be no water that will drain our rice fields. So they understand the impact and the existence of the rainforest, but sometimes they have to sacrifice their long-term well-being for their short-term well-being. We can come up with solutions, you know, and we don't really have to choose between human and forest. They can thrive together. So that's what we try to prove with our program.
Yeah, I guess that's the kind of exact role, isn't it, of your organization, is to prove that you don't have to make that kind of short-term dilemma into a long-term issue. You can actually just solve the issue then and there, and then there is no long-term issue. So health is maintained both in the short and the long term, which is wonderful. So something you kind of touched on before, because you mentioned about healthcare and how that was a real motivator for this kind of deforestation, for people to try and make some money to pay for the healthcare of their loved ones. But you also mentioned that something that came up time and time again was that they wanted to be trained in organic farming, which That kind of surprised me when you said that, because I know that that was the healthcare was a big motivation for them, but for them to say that as well, that's really interesting. So what does that involve?
Most of the loggers that working as illegal loggers, more than 50% of them, they're actually having a land to work with. But then in their ideas, even to work in your land, you still have to give away some money. You know, you need to buy manure, you need to buy fertilizer, you know, in order to make your land productive. And all of those things are getting more expensive because they keep thinking about a chemical fertilizer, because that's the one that make your plants more productive, right? In the short term. So they understand that. So instead of working on their land because they thought it's expensive, they prefer to work as illegal loggers, because you just chop down the trees, you sell the timber, and then you got the money. And then you can feed your family right away. But with working with the land, it's a process. It's not like one night process. You have to produce the seedlings first, or you have to produce the vegetable seedlings first, and then you need to plant them. You need to care for them. You need to nurture the plants before it can give you something for your to feed your family. So when they ask about organic farming training, is that they, how can we reduce our dependency on chemical fertilizer, because it's getting, the price is getting expensive and expensive. How can you teach us to plant vegetables on this barren land, for example? How can we grow rice in this area, for example? So organically and without having a needed to buy fertilizer, how can we produce our own fertilizer? So very interestingly, in the beginning of our program in 2007, we did a baseline survey. We found around more than 1,300 illegal loggers, right? And then 5 years into our program in 2012, we did again a baseline survey, and then we found out only 450 former loggers left. And then 5 years into 2017, only 150 loggers left. So there are 90% reductions just by doing organic farming training, because most of them, they have their own land so that they can easily transition into becoming a farmer once they got this training and educations on how to make their land productive. But then there is, this is goes to another story actually, but then there are 150 what we call hardcore loggers, because it's so difficult for them to transition away from being a logger, because they simply don't have enough education, they don't have land, they don't have other educations, and they cannot do anything. So they come up to us, so what about us, you know, we wanted to stop logging, but we don't have any choices. So we came out with different program at the time in 2017. So how about we bought your chainsaw and then change it into funds to start new businesses, whatever businesses that you wanted to do, we can support that. And then we can do it together. So we bought their chainsaw, we give them a funds to start new businesses. So since 2017, we keep buying chainsaw from former loggers and then support them with the new business. And so far we bought 182 chainsaws. So yeah, and it will, the number will keep continue. And then if you put it in the perspective, because this chainsaw using to log a giant tree, right? A big tree in the forest. So if you put it in a perspective, we did a small interview with them. When you own this chainsaw, how many trees that you can log in 1 week? And they say it in average 5 to 6. So if you use that number and put it into perspective, we already save a lot of trees in the forest. And then by saving a lot of these big trees, it means that we allow the forest to regrow, because the forest itself have the ability to regrow, right? And then to make it like it was before, but it needed time.
That's an awesome initiative, actually, just removing those, it almost removes temptation as well, mm-hmm. from those people. So yeah. When you buy the chainsaw, mm-hmm. what's the next step for that person? So they've sold you their chainsaw, and then what happens next with their work and the support that you offer them?
There are two types, the former loggers that we bought the chainsaw from. So the first one, we call it active loggers. And then the second one, we call it passive loggers. So from the passive loggers, they usually already have different jobs or work. They're working in different livelihood. but they still have chainsaw that oftenly rent it to other loggers who wants to do logging in the forest. So we bought chainsaw from these persons as well. And then for the active one, it means that they don't have any jobs other than logging. So their main job is logging. We bought chainsaw from them with more. So the prices for the passive one is 3 million, but the price for the active one is 4 million. And then we added more funds, a total of 10 million to start new businesses. We usually ask them, what do you want to do? And then some of them said, oh, I want to do a paddle shop. I want to open a small shop. I want to open barber. I want to open, oh, I want to start chicken farm, fish farm. And a lot of, there are actually 20 type of businesses that we support at the moment. And then how can they manage their income? Something like that. So very simple financial management. And then we bought what they needed for, you know, to start their businesses together, because we don't give them money to avoid they bought a new chainsaw. And then we tied them with an agreement. And this agreement is actually witnessed by the local authorities as well. So it's a commitment. If they are found to do logging again inside of the rainforest, then they can be arrested by the local authority. And they don't want that. Right. So it's more like this program is actually try to educate people as well as try to influence people and then try to make them understand that they're doing best bit by gave up their chainsaw to us. And then we will try our best as well to accompany them so that they can be successful in their new businesses and then can transition away from being a logger.
So obviously you've mentioned the local people who may be working as an individual or working in pairs or working in small groups, but obviously there is the issue of larger scale illegal logging and then also unsustainable commercial logging. So what is the impact that stopping these smaller loggers, how much impact is that having overall? Because on the global scale, Indonesia is obviously losing a lot of forest, and the amount that those forests have shrunk in the past 50 to 100 years is just absolutely heartbreaking. As somebody who's been to Borneo and seen those beautiful, beautiful forests, it is heartbreaking to think of that, but obviously really encouraging to know that there are these initiatives out there that are working to stop that. So what are your kind of impact measures with regards to how much forest is being saved and what impact you're having compared with those larger, bigger scale threats?
Yeah, of course, when we talk about illegal logging in Indonesia, it's more like an iceberg. You can only see the tip, but you cannot see the bottom. And usually those people with money, with special interest, those people who have money usually paid for these small scale loggers, these local community loggers, to go to the forest and then cut down the forest and then bring it back and sell it, the timber, to them. By buying the chainsaw or getting the chainsaw from this small scale logger community, it means that we cut the opportunity for those large group of loggers to asking them to go to the forest. We try to cut the demand, although we cannot say that we cut them entirely. Because it's very tricky when you talk about loggers in Indonesia, because they're very smart. Sometimes they work in the middle of the night and you don't even know. And then when you think about the size of the forest compared to how many people who actually guards the forest from the government, it's almost impossible to save the rainforest, right? That's why we try to engage with community. So we try to give a lot of incentive to the community so that they can think collectively as a community what they need to do to help us tackle this issue. For example, I mentioned earlier that we have incentive systems, right? So incentive system, actually, we give a discount for healthcare for community who help us protect the rainforest. Helping protect rainforest by means that there are no loggers in that community, there are no land poachers in that community or land grabbers. They open a new land inside the rainforest. There is no sawmill, like small timber processing company. And then we work with the community. So if the community are really looking after all of this, then they will get 70% discount. And then we colored their communities are green. So whenever they come to our clinics or our medical center to access for healthcare, oh, where are you from, for example? And then they show their identity. Oh, your village is categorized as green, then you get 70% discount. And then we constantly monitor all of this. There are 39 communities that are having a direct border with the national park. And then we work with the community. So if their communities are categorized as red, it means that it's really bad, that there's still loggers there, there's still a sawmill there, there's still access to the forest there. And then there are still people who are working for timber company, you know, illegal timber company over there. So it means that collectively they will be thinking of that because they get the benefit as a community, not as a person. So if one person in the community doing loggers, they will go to that person and then try to warn him, you know, you need to stop because of you, we will not get this discount from this medical center. So we work with the community. Of course, it's a very complex issue and we just try our best on how to reduce the impact of logging. But actually, when the community stop logging, it means that we allow the forest to grow again.
It's really great to hear that the community holds each other accountable as well. So they're on the lookout for people that might be slipping back into their old habits or things like that. And actually saying to them, if you do this, then we're going to lose our healthcare. And they might have a sick family member or something, and they would be really mad with this person for doing it. So it's almost like you don't have to police it. The role to do that is left within the local community. So yeah, that's obviously a really positive thing. So with regards to the regrowth of the forests that you've mentioned, I know you guys have got a conservation reserve that you've seen regrow. Like, what is the impact that you've seen around the forest been in the past 14 years that you've been an organization? What have you seen as positive impact of the work that you've done?
So we also have a conservation department in our program because we want to show the interconnectedness between health and conservations. So in conservations, one of our program is restorations. So I did forget to mention, when we begin our program in Gunung Palung National Park, unfortunately, 40% of the area of the rainforest has been degraded by fire because it's open. And simply because there is no natural regeneration takes place there. So it needed human intervention for the forest to regrowth, right? So we did what we call reforestations project. And we started this project in 2009. And then so far, we have successfully restored around 176 hectares. It's quite small compared to other organizations that have been working in the restorations project. But what's very interesting about our restorations project is that we're not just thinking about planting trees, but we also incorporate the thought of biodiversity. Biodiversity in terms of species and biodiversity in terms of genetics. So we try to incorporate this into our restorations project because we believe that if we want to restore the forest later, we're not just planting the trees and then allow the trees to grow, but eventually it will create ecosystems. It will create habitat for wildlife animal to stay on it, right? So since 2009, we work in a three different restorations area. There's one area that we called a corridor, wildlife corridor, because of the forest area are very fragmented. So we need to connect it between one area of the forest to another area of the forest so that the wildlife animal, especially orangutan, because the national park that we're working with is actually one of the last habitat of a wild orangutan. And orangutan needs quite larger area for them to have an activity. So we built a corridor and since 2009 and in 2012. And this corridor is actually functioning. So through our camera traps, we saw orangutan build nests and then orangutan passing by the wildlife corridor from one forest to another forest. And then we also have different conservations program. We also have the chainsaw buyback program that I just mentioned to you. And then we also help widows, the most vulnerable in the community, to raise goats. So we gave them one female goats, and then we rent them male goats so that they can mate and then produce baby goats. So the second baby goats will then be giving back to Asri for us to giving it to new widows. So we also have that program. And we also have that farming, organic farming training program in our program as well. And then we work with the community. So we also have the representative of the communities that are being educated. And then they have meeting every month to discuss about our program. So they kind of like our key person in the community. So it's the our go-to person in the community to ask about how community is doing. Is there any suggestions or is there any improvement that we need to make in our program? So all of the input from the community.
So is this related to, you mentioned earlier about non-cash payments yes. for healthcare. So mm. is part of that, so is that how they can pay for their healthcare if, yes. if even the 70% discount isn't enough for, mm. for them to afford?
Yeah, so because in the beginning, they asked for affordable healthcare, right? And then affordable by means that even if you don't have money, you can still access it. And that's what we provide to the community. So if they don't have money, they still have these options where they can pay with seedlings. They can pay with seeds, they can pay with manure, they can pay, some of them even pay with eggshells. And then they can, even if they don't have all of this, they can still work at Asri, at Asri Clinic. They can help with cleaning, a lot of work that they can help with to pay for their healthcare.
And just to backtrack slightly about Gunung Palung, that's the first area where you started. Mm. This is a really special place, and you obviously mentioned orangutan, but that area is incredibly biodiverse and a real pocket of just unique and special wildlife. So obviously you guys are from around there, which is why that project was started. But what else is in that area that is so important to protect?
The size of the, it's one of the park that has all complete type of ecosystems from the beach to mangrove to tropical lowland to peat swamp to highland. It's very rare to see national park in Indonesia that has all of the this type of ecosystem in one place. And that's why. And it's high biodiversity as well. So there's a lot of critical endangered tree species found there, that if you go deep into the forest, there are still a lot of trees that are really giant trees. So you can barely hug the trees. And then you need 5 to 7 people to circling around the trees, holding hands, that very old trees. If you're thinking about those trees must have been thousand years old. And then it's been the tree that has been seen by our ancestor and their ancestor. So by protecting this, it means that we kind of like leaving legacy to our next generations. If we saw that tree, our generations must see that tree. And then this type of thinking that we also try to bring to community when we educate them, when we talk to them. I was having a very interesting conversations with one communities when we asked them to plant those native endangered tree species in their garden. I asked them, have you seen this tree lately in this neighborhood? And then they say, oh, no. Yeah, thank you for reminding me, because when I grew up, I saw this tree a lot. And then now I rarely see it. And I want my children to see it and my grandchildren to see it. And then if I plant now, even my grandchildren will keep seeing it growth. They're very excited to start. Oh, yeah. Can I have some of the seedlings that you have? Can I plant them in my garden? It's very unique forest as well. If you like in Indonesia, especially Kalimantan or Borneo, it's actually kind of like source of the old forest, mega biodiversity. And then there's a lot of not just like tree species, but also wild animal species. You know, like that monkey with long nose, we call it Bekantan. Yeah. You know, they also,
I think we call it proboscis. Proboscis monkey.
Yeah, proboscis monkey.
Yeah.
So proboscis monkey also have their own habitat in peat swamp. If the peat swamp area is gone, then the habitat is gone. So we have to protect them.
When I was there, I went to go and see those monkeys, and I've never seen a stranger animal in my entire life. They don't actually look real. And if anyone's listening and wants to know what one is, definitely look it up and share it around, because it'll brighten up everyone's day at this point in time, that's for sure. But something that I want to share with you, so when I was in Borneo,
I was
in Kota Kinabalu, and then we went to Sepalok, but then there was a river near there, and we did a boat cruise down it. And one of the most special things I've ever seen in my entire life of being a wildlife biologist was when our guide stopped, and you could hear this rustling in the forest. We were sat there and he wouldn't tell us what it was, and then suddenly a group of pygmy elephants started crossing the river in front of us. And it gives me goosebumps even thinking about it now. Like, this area is so special and so wonderful, and there's so many unique and beautiful animals there. That one of the many reasons I admired this program so much was that it is saving this absolutely unique gem of an area that it's like nowhere else on the planet, and it does really, really need support and help to survive what's happening around it at the moment. So it's a wonderful place, and it's really, really good to hear that there is this program, and there's a lot of NGOs that work in the area with various different species, with various different ecosystems, and then obviously you guys working with the local communities.
We have several campaign, tree planting campaign as well. And then the newest one is that carbon offset. Have you heard about it? So it's like you change your carbon footprint into planting trees. So you try to measure how many carbon footprint that you leave every month, and then try to calculate it into how much money you can donate or how many trees you need to plant it. And then we work with a lot of organizations that are focusing on that platform. And then we try to plant trees as much as possible, because we also in this together to tackle the climate change issue that we're facing right now.
So I was actually going to ask you about fundraising.
We are open for donations. So if you want to donate for our program, really, you can just go to our website and then look for donations, and then, donate.
So if people do want to donate after listening to information about this incredible organization, then they can head on over to the website and even get rid of their carbon footprint by supporting you guys to plant some trees. Is that right?
Yeah. And then donation by means, it's not all about money. It's also even by sharing our social media to your colleagues, or even spread the informations about organizations, or even read some of the story from the rainforest, or maybe you can also come when we allowing to travel again, then you can also visit our organizations and then learn and then do some exchange knowledge, because we receive a lot of exchange students before the pandemic. So there's a lot of people from around the world come to our organizations and then stay for a month or for 2 months doing voluntary work. Or if you are professional, you can do some exchange knowledge. It's not just like one side giving, it's like both ways. We also can learn from you, you can learn from us, you know, and then you can spread the word about the organization. So there's a lot of way to donate. It's not just all about money.
Great. So obviously I know you operate within healthcare quite a lot. So those work exchange people, are they often nurses, doctors, healthcare professionals? Do you get volunteers who come over that work in those fields and kind of go and help at the clinic, or is it more people that want to do organic farming, or is it everything?
Yeah, most of our volunteers or our guests is coming from different backgrounds. Like you mentioned earlier, medical professional, nurses, dentists, and then health professional. There's a lot of vet as well, because we have our goats programs, and then try to educate our staff as well with zoonosis. There's a lot of people coming from different backgrounds. Education, to help our education team to build curriculum, to build a way to talk more in a simple way and educate in an interesting way to children, so that we can engage them, because they are really to be the next generation that will be thinking about this stuff as well. So they need to be educated since earlier. So yeah, there's a lot of people from various type of backgrounds as well.
My mum's a nurse, and I obviously love wildlife in Borneo. So there may be a post-COVID trip from my family. You never know. So obviously we've discussed what you're doing in Gunung Palung, but is there, I know that you guys want to replicate the project and try and have an even bigger impact. So is that something that you guys are looking to do at the moment? Is it already happened? Has it been affected by the current global situation? And how, what's in the future for your organization?
Yeah, so at the moment, we can only really take this model to scale across the whole tropics and work to help save all the remaining tropical rainforests. If we can prove that matching rainforest community solutions to global resources works as well, and in other contexts as well. So in 2018, we are replicating our model in a second site in Bukit Baka, Bukit Raya National Park, BBBR National Park that I just mentioned earlier. And our sister organizations are called Health in Harmony, based in the US. They replicate our model in Madagascar and in Brazil. So we try also, hopefully next year, to expand our program to Papua.
How are those programs working out? Are they as successful? Are you, I can imagine there's different issues between different communities and that kind of thing. But obviously, it's had such a massive impact in the community there. Mm-hmm. Is it as successful in other areas of the world?
It's actually working really well. But what we've learned from scaling the impact of our program is that even in a totally different cultural context, like Madagascar and Brazil, what's fascinating is that everywhere we have done radical listening with the community, we hear similar themes, although the details are very specific, but we hear similar themes about the needed for healthcare and the needed for organic farming training. So this is, even in Madagascar, even in Brazil, there's always a link between human health and the health of the environment and how we can protect the environment by giving an educations or training to improve their alternative livelihood. So
have there been any surprising answers that have come up from other parts of the world other than healthcare and organic farming? Has there been any other answers that you thought, oh, okay, how do we kind of conquer that? Or is it quite a similar
education thing everywhere? It's education, because most of the rainforest community, if their children wants to have an education, they have to send them to the city. And usually when they go to the city, they kind of like change their perspective. It can be good or it can be bad. But what they want us to do is that if we can also support education so that their children don't have to leave home, don't have to leave them, so that their children can stay true to their identity and to their value as the community, rainforest community, that would be really good. And then we try to communicate this with a local NGO that's focused on educations that working in the same landscape or in the same region. So, yeah.
That's great. So as an expansion of the project, that's including education would be the next step. I think that's about all I've got to ask you. Apart from it, have you got anything else that you want to share about the program or about your role?
I actually have an encouragement to our listener today. I have one question for all of them. Try to think, what is your part in creating a healthier future for us all? Because I believe strongly that every single one of us has a role to play, and I know together we can do it.
Oh, a message of hope at last. It's just wonderful speaking with somebody who's so optimistic, because I am as well, and it can be easy to get bogged down with all of the grandeur of the global issues that we have to combat with the environment and with conservation and with human health and with everything. But speaking with you today has been so wonderful, and it's filled me with so much hope. So I hope the listeners are feeling the same thing. Yeah. And if you want to support in any of the ways that Deeka has mentioned, head on over to the show notes and we'll put all of the links to the website up, and you can go on there and support one of the programs or all of the programs, or plant some trees or share, do whatever you can do to support this amazing organization. So thank you so much, Deeka. I've loved talking to you today.
Thank you so much as well for giving us this platform and opportunity to talk about our wonderful organization. So thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Earth to Humans podcast. Earth to Humans is a production of the Wildlands Collective, and today's episode was produced by Hannah Mulvaney. Our senior producer is Serena Simons. If you liked what you heard, go ahead and hit that subscribe button so you can stay up to date on all things Earth to Humans. For show notes of today's episode, visit wildlandsinc.org/ETH226. Our intro music was edited by Wildlands Collective member Jason Milligan, and music for today's episode comes from Arrington de Dioniso and Blue Dot Sessions.